Someone asked me if I could explain what non-dual means. So, you know, what we mean when we're using that term. So I'll just give a brief explanation of that. So non-dual is an expression that refers to an approach to spiritual freedom, realizing spiritual freedom, in which there is a beginning. We begin by understanding that we are that universal being, that allness, everythingness, no thingness, that we're not a particular thing, a separate self. That nothing we can experience can take us away from that truth. Nothing that we can do or say can remove us from that truth. We may be asleep to that truth. We may live in a dream or a nightmare which separates us from realizing that. So in most spiritual practices, including a lot of Buddhist practices, Buddhism is a non-dual teaching. And the term non-dual actually derives from the Advaita Vedanta tradition, which comes out of that body of teaching that we roughly call Hinduism. A modern teacher of non-dual truth is Ramana Maharshi. And he has a whole lineage, many of whom are Westerners now teaching the non-dual. Most spiritual traditions, although they may have a non-dual heart, essence, will be taught in a way that communicates that somehow we have to become different, we have to do certain practices, you know, we have to become more this and less that. There's no denying that developing skill, virtue, love brings us more into a congruence with non-dual reality. Because when we express love, when we express generosity and ethics, we are living in congruence with the truth that we are everyone. When I harm you, I harm myself. When I harm myself, I harm the world. There is no separation. The problem is that so many of us think that that's the goal, is to become, you know, a better person. And it stops there. And that, you know, we're... So the realization of this wholeness, this that we are that, we are God, we are the ground of being, this is forgotten or not communicated, especially as religions become institutionalized. And, you know, we can see it in every tradition, including Buddhism. I think that in Buddhism, the non-dual teachings are a lot more clear and apparent than they are in some of the other traditions. Like, for many years, I was a Christian, and I became I felt like I hit a wall in that spirituality, even though I knew that the truth of it was a non-dual teaching. So, I'm tending not to use the expression non-dual so much anymore. When I planned this retreat, I was using it. So I'm tending to use, other words that point to what I've just expressed. So I'd like to talk a little bit today about in what I'm going to offer about what keeps us from recognizing this reality that we are life itself, that we are interconnected, that we are ultimate truth, that's who we truly are in our essence, and that the manifestation of life that we are is already perfect. So there are different factors of mind that are pointed to, and I'm going to shift gears a little bit and move into a bit more conceptual mode. There are different factors of mind that are talked about in the Dharma teachings of the Buddha. And one of the key factors that he talks about is perception. So perception is used, as all terms in Buddhism are used, in a quite precise way. Perception is the capacity of the mind to recognize the distinctive marks of an object, and it's very closely associated with the faculty of memory. So for example, when we were learning language, we learned that the object that many of you are sitting on is called a chair. Or chaise, if you speak French, or another word in another language. But we learn a word that's associated with that object. And we recognize that there are certain marks of a chair. Now, what we're describing in this room is a very simple object, but you could recognize a carved wooden object with four legs shaped similarly, and you would know immediately it was a chair. So that's an example of perception. So it names, identifies, classifies, discriminates, and categorizes experiences. And so perception is very useful because it helps the mind to recognize forms. Through the visual sense, we recognize forms, we see forms. Through the ear, we hear sounds, And we recognize sounds, you know, so we'll name, the mind will name, you know, a bird or an airplane or a dog barking. So some people have very developed perceptions and really develop their perceptions. So some people will hear a bird and they'll think a robin or a cardinal, you know, or swallow. You know, this ear hears, you know, I can distinguish between a crow and a songbird, but not much beyond that. But people can actually take great pride in how they develop their perceptions. So an artist may look at a painting and see, you know, all the different colors and will see, oh, you know, this is this shade, you know, so ochre and you know, some other raw umber and, you know, different shades, and will name all of these different tones and colors and so on. And so we, you know, there are people who do this with tastes, like gourmets who have, you know, really subtle distinguishing of the tongue, and people who are wine experts and so on. So there can be a feeling of pleasure in the development of perception, until we, you know, we can develop, you know, the pitfall is that many of us develop a sense of self around it, you know. So I, you know, this is my expertise and so on. So as soon as we are developing a sense of self around it, we're moving into, you know, I'm better than, and I am so skilled, and then we can feel threatened. Oh, I wonder if somebody else is better than me, or maybe I won't be able to, you know, say the right thing. So as soon as we're building a sense of self around our perceptions, we're into stress and suffering. Perception also colors our experience, because perceptions are conditioned by the past. So perhaps in one's life, you know, one had a very unpleasant teacher, you know, maybe in third grade or something, and, you know, it was and she had gray hair that was tied up in a bun. And actually, I had a teacher with gray hair tied up in a bun, and she was my favorite teacher, Mrs. Bingley. but you know, maybe there's an unpleasant association, and so the perception gets formed that, you know, oh, women, elderly women with gray hair tied up in a bun, you know, they're not very nice. You know, or they are very nice, you know. So it's a perception, and it becomes a barrier to our engaging with a fresh mind, fresh eyes, an open heart with this gray-haired woman. So this can be a distortion, which can lead us into, you know, more misunderstanding, suffering, and so on, causing suffering to somebody, perhaps. So we become attached and identified with our perceptions. Perceptions can develop into beliefs. And so So since whatever is manifesting in the world is impermanent, and perceptions may be static, or our perception may be influenced by our emotional state at a particular time, if we hold on to our perceptions as being true or being ourself, you know, we're going to come to grief in some way. So when perception arises and there's no mindfulness, there's no you know, presence, attention in the moment, we're seeing only the surface of things. So, you know, say I walk into the office and I see Mary, you know, my colleague at work, and the perception is, oh, there's Mary. And I say, good morning, Mary, and I walk past her and I sit down at my desk. You know, I may not notice that Mary looks tired, sad, sick, joyful, particularly beautiful. I'm not seeing who Mary is in this moment. I'm just glossing over Mary. Not really taking in the reality of, you know, who she is right now. Another perception that is very common is around ownership. So we think, you know, I own. This is mine. This piece of land is mine. You know, this item of clothing is mine. This iPad is mine. And so, you know, we have this sense of somehow it's connected to me. Well, That's a common way in our society of understanding objects and their relationship to us. I remember one of the first retreats I went to at the Insight Meditation Society, and Joseph Goldstein was talking about his experience practicing in India. And he had this little radio that he brought over with him, and he took it around with him and occasionally would listen to it, and I guess he left it, you know, in a place that he thought was safe, and it disappeared, He said in the talk, he said, you know, and I was really, really upset. And then I figured out that the reason that I was upset was because I thought it belonged to me. And that really bothered me. I thought, what do you mean you thought you belonged to you? Of course it belonged to you. It's your radio. You bought it. And it took me a long time to realize that, you know, there's nothing that we can cling to as mine. You know, according to the social rules of our society, it's wrong to steal, but it's not, there's nothing intrinsically me or mine about anything. that, you know, I use, I wear. And the idea that we own a piece of land, of course, created a lot of misunderstanding when Europeans came over and they encountered the native people, who had a very different understanding about how we live with the earth and on the earth. And they understood, perhaps, that they would share the use of the earth. They didn't understand until maybe it was too late that the Europeans had this idea that, well, it's mine, and that means it belongs to me alone, so you get off. So this way of perception can really shape the way we engage with life. And so it's important to understand perception. We need perceptions. I mean, we want to know that a chair is a chair. Is water self? Is this water myself? Well, I mean, if you saw a jug of water on a table, you would say, no, it's not myself. At what point does it become myself? You know, food, air. So we have this perception of self as first of all, existing in time and being constant in time, because I remember being a child. I remember that I lived somewhere. That was me that lived there. You know, so because we can remember something, or because we can project into the future with our imagination, and we can say, I'm going to move to France, and so we imagine that we are going to move to France. But the person who moves to France is not the person who decides. It's not to say there's no continuity. There's some continuity. But there is also a kind of a flow, a process of change. It's not the same. You know, I'm not the same me that arrived here on Thursday afternoon. So we have so much identity, so much attachment to this perception of self. And it really is the essential thing that keeps us from realizing who we truly are, our inherent freedom, our inherent boundlessness, the boundlessness of love that we are. So what we have been doing in our practice is bringing our practice to this spacious awareness and approach that I have been encouraging is to stay grounded in the body, because our minds are so full of stories of self, stories of who I am, stories of who I was, who I want to be, stories of what I prefer and what I dislike, stories of, you know, projecting how others are seeing me and taking that to be true. So perception can come into play as we bring our attention into the body, but the perceptions are less fixed in a story. We may have a sense of something being, you know, a painful perception, a painful experience, or we may judge a sensation in the body as something that we like or we don't like, or we want or we don't want, or it's good or it's bad. But because sensations are so fluid and because they are not so connected to words, it's easier to work with them. They're more workable. Of course, we begin, you know, to also look at the mind, and we begin to see that the thoughts that we have believed in so strongly are arising selflessly. They're arising from causes and conditions. They're not mine. They're not me. Did you ever decide to think something? Thoughts just come into the mind. So you may say, okay, I'm going to decide to think about an elephant. You know, so where did that decision come from? So when we begin to really examine the flow of experience in the body, in the mind, we see that that these experiences are selfless. So they're passing. They're arising, passing away. We don't need to reject them. We don't need to control them or repress them. No. When we're attuned to the body, you know, we begin to recognize which thoughts, which emotions bring us toward happiness and which bring us toward stress and suffering. It's something that we learn through our practice. And it happens, it unfolds. We don't need to you know, strive and strive. We just need to keep showing up. Showing up in this moment, showing up in our practice. We just need to make that commitment to be present in each moment of experience. So maybe I can, instead of talking more, maybe I can invite, I'd like to invite questions or responses to these ideas that I've presented. how do you engage with these?
Could you relate maybe more closely how the concepts that you've just expressed are associated with or relate to the three portals that you mentioned?
So three portals that John is referring to are the stillness and silence and spaciousness. So these portals are entries into an unconditioned awareness, a simple presence in which we're not identifying as a self. So when we are attending to stillness, we're recognizing that all movement, all action, all activity is arising in the context of stillness. So stillness within, stillness without, there's no difference, there's no ultimate boundary between the stillness that is present in the body and on the earth, in the air, all around us. So that stillness brings us into a more expanded presence, you know, out of this, you know, I'm doing this, I'm lifting my hand, I'm, you know, walking. So we're finding stillness within us, around us. Silence. So silence, all of the sound that we hear arises in silence and is permeated by silence. So even sound like the song of a bird, you know, if we listen very, very carefully, there's silence right within it. And it arises from and returns to silence and space. So all form, all manifestation arises and returns to space and manifests within space and the space within us, the space around us. So we begin to this sense of boundary of I am this thing, this object, begins to break down. Another beautiful contemplation is the contemplation of the four elements. It's one of my favorite contemplations. So this the four elements is an ancient way of thinking about totality. So earth, fire, water, and air. And so one of the contemplations that the Buddha taught in the discourses on mindfulness was, you know, to contemplate the elements within the body and outside the body. And so we recognize that the warmth of the body is the energy of the sun, you know, because we've taken in, we've ingested that energy in the form of vegetables or animals, and its body transmutes it back into that fire of the sun. You know, the air within the body, you know, breathing in, breathing out. When, you know, this breath, is this in-breath, is this me? You know, is it not, no, as I breathe out, is it not me? You know, we share the breath with everyone, we breathe out carbon dioxide, the plants breathe it in and breathe out oxygen. So there's a breathing in, breathing out, you know, of all the world. And water, the water that we drink is the same water that was drunk and excreted by the earliest forms of life. So these contemplations really bring us into an immediate connection with the truth, you know, that we're not this self, you know, that we take ourselves to be, that we have so invested in our comfort and our happiness, and of course, I don't want to speak categorically. There are many acts of love and generosity and giving of ourselves and resonating with compassion and empathy that we experience that really are an expression of our interconnectedness with and that we are life, that we are not separate. And yet there is this core belief, you know, that I'm this. And so we examine that and we see how this clinging to self is what keeps us from realizing the freedom and the love and the joy that we are. So it doesn't mean that, you know, when I wake up from this dream of separateness, that I, you know, I start, you know, feeding somebody else instead of feeding myself dinner. You know, I forget, you know, the relative reality that, you know, that I need to put my socks on these feet, not those. So of course, you know, we remember that, but there's a way in which that holding to that belief dissolves.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Yeah. How is it possible? So, if you're talking about relative reality, and then we have the absolute reality. So, would you say that it's possible to live constantly, permanently, in the absolute reality? That means with no sense of the self at all. In our society, I mean.
Yeah, I don't think so.
No.
Now there's we can open to that. The mind, heart, being opens to that, and is transformed by it. And then we have to go to the bathroom, and eat our breakfast and feed the dog. You know, so. We can live, I think, with a deep sense of connection, so that, you know, we recognize that somebody's pain is our own, that somebody's loss or the exploitation of somebody is not a distant kind of event that doesn't touch us. So I think that we can live in that deep connection. But there is, we wouldn't, you know, there's a balance that needs to be found. And engaging in this world is engaging, you know, as somebody. You know, like Catherine engages in this world in a way that is an expression of, you know, your talents and your interests and your creativity, and it's not what I could do, and so, you know, and so Daryl engages in this world in ways that flow naturally from my predispositions, perhaps genetic predispositions, perhaps and certainly cultural and, you know, upbringing factors, and all the ways that I was formed and shaped as a human being.
Can you elaborate on when you say being able to relate to someone's pain and feel someone's pain? Like, because I've heard that before, and I can relate to it. I can see how someone is maybe in pain, but how, I think the way you're describing it is a little bit different.
The word compassion is points to an experience of attunement. And the Buddha described compassion as the quivering of the heart in resonance to, you know, somebody's suffering. So compassion is a willingness to stay connected, you know, to not turn away, because when we are observing or present with somebody who's hurting, sometimes, you know, we don't want to stick around, either physically or maybe emotionally. You know, we want to withdraw, and so compassion is something that really calls forth something from us, and it's I think compassion requires connection and an open heart and a kind of fearlessness to be with someone. So so yeah, that's what I'm talking about.
Daryl, when you're talking in your talk about showing up in the moment and commitment to being in the moment, as opposed to just getting caught up in that crazy tangle of thoughts and past future.
Yeah.
And just letting that go and...
Right, coming back and being present to...
Your breath or your body or whatever.
To the body, to the sensitivity of being present with... whatever is emerging right now. So let's take just a couple of minutes to come back to silence and being respectful of the cook's request that we not be late. Just taking a couple of minutes in silence. Actually, I'm going to read a poem. It's a poem by Hafiz, a 14th century Persian poet. There is a game we should play, and it goes like this. We hold hands and look into each other's eyes and scan each other's face. Then I say, now, tell me a difference you see between us. and you might respond, Hafiz, your nose is 10 times bigger than mine. Then I would say, yes, my dear, almost 10 times. But let's keep playing. Let's go deeper. Go deeper. For if we do, our spirits will embrace and interweave. Our union will be so glorious that even God will not be able to tell us apart. There is a wonderful game we should play with everyone, and it goes like this.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.